are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 16th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, monopolies, bank bills, and primaries with David Dayen of nearly every publication you've ever read. Also on the program today, did Dems just have a Tea Party moment? Primaries across the country, progressive candidates beat out many of the established moderates. Women in DSA win big in the Pennsylvania primaries.
Hell yeah.
And sadly, key Democrats in the Senate cave on Gina Haspel. But not after, or I should say, after making sure that none of their fellow Democrats could read the damning reports on Gina Haspel.
Who wants to read that?
Meanwhile, documents show White House felt that the climate panel had too few climate deniers. Jeff Merkley pushes for stricter controls over the authorization for the use of military force. Good luck with that. No one can absorb the idea that Donald Trump, or why Donald Trump, would want to help a Chinese company with jobs just after the Chinese government gave $1 billion for a project that he was closely affiliated with. Meanwhile, back in the White House eliminates the top cyber security advisor post because why would you need that? Kim Jong-un is now starting his second act of playing Donald Trump, headed towards the third act and the denouement, wherein Donald Trump will end up basically probably just announcing a nuclear assault on the country.
Nuclear denouement.
Jeff Sessions announces last night that cops need not worry about civil rights violations anymore. Not when it comes to the DOJ oversight. And lastly, North Carolina. The latest teachers across the country to strike for not just better wages, but more spending per student on education around the country. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, as we now get into the middle of the week. This breaking news just out, Michigan State University, reaches a $500 million settlement with Larry Nassar's victim. Larry Nassar, of course, was the coach, the gymnastics coach, or I guess a doctor. Is he a doctor? He was a gymnastics doctor.
He was a doctor, a pediatrician, right?
Well, and he was a sports doctor. And he worked both for Michigan State University and for the USA gymnastics program. I'm not sure what the official title is of that. But and he was sentenced up to, I think it was 125 years in prison. There's not enough time, I think, for how long he should have been able to go to prison. I don't think that we know. We have a sense of how much that time. He assaulted and molested, was it 70 women? More, maybe. Michigan State apparently has reached a $500 million settlement with the women and students assaulted by Larry Nassar. Yesterday we played for you.
No, it was more than 160 women.
Oh, really? Jesus. Unbelievable. Yesterday we played for you an ad by a guy, Pat Davis. Pat Davis is running for where is he? Where is he running now?
Albuquerque in New Mexico.
Yeah, in New Mexico, right? Exactly. And he, underfunded, running the Democratic primary, wanted to make a bit of a splash, and he had the ad where he basically said, well, not basically said, he said, "F the NRA," and he didn't say F. And apparently, this ad has to run because it's a political ad, has to run without being censored on Arizona television. Good for him. And the ad appears to be incredibly effective because here's a guy who did not have funding, could not get media coverage, obviously had a specific message. He is a former cop, and but also serious progressive bona fides. And look, we played the ad, and the ad apparently got him booked on Fox TV, Fox News. And here is Tucker Carlson just absolutely amazed about this ad.
Pat Davis joins us tonight for New Mexico. Pat, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Tucker.
So that's the ad, F the NRA? Kind of moronic, no?
That's it, just 15 seconds, but it got a whole lot of attention to start a new conversation about guns, and I'm grateful for that.
But doesn't it degrade you? I mean, you use the F word in an ad. I mean, if you have a position, state it, but F the NRA? I mean, come on.
Well, Tucker, I mean, look, being polite, it hasn't made our schools any safer. It hasn't protected police officers like I used to be. You know, if a cuss word on TV offends you more than pictures of dead children in Parkland or Newtown, then your priorities are all wrong. I was a cop
but
when
it's
the
not either
assault
or.
Weapons
hold on,
ban
wait,
was so in
I
place,
don't care
and
if you're
worked.
A cop or not. Wait, hold on. Wait, let me ask you a question. It's not an either
sure.
or, and it's not that I'm so offended. I just politeness doesn't work. Do you think rudeness will? Is rudeness going to save lives? Do you think
rudeness?
Well. You know, as we were looking to make this ad, what we kept coming up with the same idea, and every ad idea we came up with to talk about this issue looked like somebody else's. And those had not worked. Clearly, this got the NRA's attention, and it has started a new conversation, both amongst candidates running for office about who we can, how we organize and take back Congress and put new leaders there to take on gun control, but also how we stand up to the NRA. I mean, we know what works. 50% of NRA members.
No, it started a conversation about how embarrassing
all right, let's now here. So this is what's so funny about this. Tucker is sitting there. He's talking to a cop. He is desperately trying to figure out how he was going to do this. I mean, because even some of Tucker's audience, some probably pick up on the irony of Tucker Carlson poo-pooing this guy for saying the F word in an ad, as opposed to the president of the United States, right? The idea that Tucker Carlson's never said that word before. His virgin ears have never heard the word F before. And
rude.
So he's going on. And now, oh, incidentally, did you not know that Tucker Carlson is one of those guys who blindfolded can reassemble his AR-15? Yeah, no, he's a serious, he's not staffed with a bunch of people who look up technical details of guns in some way.
Isn't this rude?
This is stuff he knows off the top of his head.
Here in New Mexico, you can go to a parking lot or go on the internet, buy an assault weapon, an AR-15, and buy a legally available add-on that, like a bump stock, that allows you to replicate exactly what happened in Las Vegas. The Las Vegas shooter.
So how many?
Wait, hold on.
Are you saying an AR-15 can shoot 150 rounds in 15 seconds? So would it have a 150-round magazine? Let me ask. Let's be specific. That's your ad. What would that magazine look like, the 150-round magazine?
Exactly like the magazines that Las Vegas police officers pulled out of that hotel room. They had 50 and 100-round magazines,
150
and that weapon was capable.
Oh.
No,
and
50
so you
and
can 100-round
magazines.
It is physically possible to fire. It's not. I mean, these are rhetorical questions. You don't know what you're talking about. And I know that you were a police officer. You claim to have been.
For 1 second. Yeah. Police officer. When was the last time you think Tucker Carlson ever said the words police officer? Oh, big police officer.
Wait, after police.
You're a big police officer.
NWA Tucker Carlson.
NWA Tucker Carlson.
I mean, it's quite clear that, like, if you start to realize, like, Tucker Carlson's audience doesn't even, like, tune in to see him win an argument. They just tune in to see him argue. That's it. Just to see what he's willing to do. I mean, the irony of all of this is, like, it is so debasing to Tucker because it is so inconsistent. Let's play just a little bit more because it's worth watching Tucker just get really flustered and frustrated by this guy because I got to say, as a candidate, this guy is staying on message and Tucker's trying to pull him off.
Questions. You don't know what you're talking about. And I know that you were a police officer. You claim
Tucker,
to have been. No AR-15 can fire 150 rounds in 15 seconds. That's untrue. And if you believe it is true, then you're not qualified to have a conversation about guns. People are laughing at you because you are ignorant. You don't know what you're talking about.
We take exactly the word of the police officers in Las Vegas, who I trust, who ran into that room to save people down below and found the weapons that were modified with bump stocks. They would allow them
to do that.
So they
say an AR-15 can shoot. What do you think would happen to the barrel in 15 seconds if you put 150 rounds? It would melt. So I guess my point is, if you're going to take on the NRA and be Mr. Tough, I was a cop guy, maybe you should know what you're talking about, but you don't. You're putting something on television that's demonstrably wrong, that's physically impossible, and all of your voters are like, oh, yeah, this guy knows what he's talking about. He was a cop. But you don't know. So maybe you should apologize for it.
I'm not apologizing for taking on the NRA.
I'm sorry, politeness doesn't work. I think you should apologize for saying something that's factually untrue.
Apologies and politeness have not changed the conversation. We need new folks to take over.
Yeah, that's why I'm not being polite. I'm trying to get a real conversation going here.
Pause it. So wait a second. We started off with Tucker Carlson saying, why do you have to be so rude in your ad? Now we're ending with Tucker saying, like, I don't have to be polite to have a conversation. I want to have a real conversation, right? I want to have a real conversation. I want this to be genuine and authentic. So let's just both start swearing. Wait, no, that's why I had you on the show. Continue.
Let's drop the social norms.
You don't know what you're talking about, so maybe you shouldn't be in a position to make decisions because you don't understand the issue. Because you just told me with a straight face that an AR-15 can fire 150 rounds in 15 seconds. Ooh, surprise, it can't. So maybe you should admit that and move on to something you understand. Would you do that?
Tucker, this is exactly the type of arguments that don't get us where we need to be. We need new leaders in Congress.
Oh, it's not
that's
like F the NRA. That's the kind of argument we need. I thought politeness didn't work, tough guy.
Politeness is not working so far. If you woke up on Mother's Day and don't have your kid anymore,
you know what works? Actually, facts work. Why don't you get some facts? Oh, Pat, do you like this new mode of communication we have? F the NRA, Pat.
It'd be great to have.
Tough guy.
It'd be great
to have something about guns and get back to me. Interview over. Yeah, because you don't know what you're talking about.
I think he went a little overkill on that one. No, because Tucker's more effective when he gets the other person all freaked out and he's kind of like, well, I'm just asking questions. But he got
he
got threatened by something in that interview.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know what? I'll tell you what the hint was. The tough guy. The repeating of the tough guy. Because what? I mean, for all the things that Tucker Carlson must feel about himself, I have a feeling being the tough guy, probably not high on the list.
Just because you could literally break me in half doesn't mean you're the tough guy.
He's so annoying.
I know facts about guns because I was up last night on my BlackBerry.
I will say that I think it was probably too reserved of the candidate not to say, like,
yeah, he needed to get a little more animated.
Like I say, I'm a police officer. When you've had a gun flash in your face, Tucker, why don't you tell me about this?
Yeah, listen, you puffy-faced jackass. I've actually dealt with these things and care about the consequences of them while you bloviate on TV and pretend you know something about guns. That would work. But yeah, that's Tucker's best move is like, I have a professor with no media training and she's going to defend a dumb student op-ed from Oberlin.
Right.
And I'm going to make her look like an idiot. Yeah. That's his zone.
Not the
Don't go after.
Guy.
Yeah, please. Oh yeah. All right. Tough guy. It's just so funny.
Well, it's also funny too, because this guy was one of the most mild-mannered people I've ever seen on television. I mean,
plus, he's like, well, I don't know that I'm a tough guy. I was a police officer and have firearm training.
Exactly.
My concern, Tucker, is the wanton murder of children. Oh, okay, tough guy. You're scared. You're upset about innocent kids
that
dying.
That is one of those interviews where you really get the sense that Tucker went and yelled at the producers. Like, next time, get me somebody who's live, okay? Not somebody who's just going to sit there and make me look like the psycho. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to... Oh, just a reminder, folks. This program relies on its members to exist. And so if you are one of those people who enjoy this program on a daily basis, or even like a thrice weekly basis, or help us once a week basis, you can help support the free show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, what we do is we give you an hour plus, hour and a half of extra content every day. So that's jointhemajorityreport.com. Quick break. When we come back, David Dayan. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. On the phone, ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan, writer for just about every publication that you have probably ever read, I would say.
Cat's Fancy.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, is there a publication that you have not written for that you think in the back of your head, David, like, I want to write for them, and I haven't had the chance to write for them.
You know what's funny is, right out of college, my first job was at Highlights for Children magazine. So, even them I have written for.
Wow. Wow. I'd like to go back and check out that piece. What was that about? Was that about mortgage lending, or was that about antitrust?
I think this, this was the early mid-90s, so it would have to be something about midnight basketball leagues or,
right.
something to do with the Gingrich Revolution.
Folks can check that out if you have a subscription to Highlights. You can go back into their archives and just search Gingrich and try and find
that. Check out your local dentist's office. Yeah.
All right. Well, so David, let's go through the elections last night. Mostly all primaries, although there was a couple of special elections for some state races. And to the extent that there is a summation, a meme going around, and that is to a certain extent, like, is this, and I think this is a little bit sloppy, but there was a little bit of Tea Party action from the Democratic base, or really, it's just really more the progressive base is picking up a little bit of steam.
Yeah, I mean, I think to call it Tea Party action is... you know, that equivalence seems false to me. But yes, it's definitely the case that candidates who you would see as more progressive, who on an ideological scale would be more liberal, did do very well last night. This was also correlated with the fact that female candidates did quite well last night. But there are a number of races, particularly in Pennsylvania, where Democrats really turned out and liberal Democrats really turned out. You saw both in the House races, in the statewide race for lieutenant governor, where an incumbent lost, actually finished in fourth. And John Fetterman, who is this hulking tattooed candidate from Braddock, Pennsylvania, ended up becoming the nominee. And even the state legislative races in western Pennsylvania, where two members of Democratic Socialists of America defeated two brothers in separate races who were longtime kind of political dynasty conservative Democrats in the state legislature in Pennsylvania. And those races were won by the two DSA members. So, and I think DSA won 4 out of 5 state legislative seats that they participated in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, I mean, you definitely saw an ideological desire to put forward big ideas and big solutions to our problems.
Now, I think those two guys, I think they're cousins. I don't know if they're brothers, but that's not, it's not terribly relevant. They're related, I guess. They come from the same sort of
same last name.
Same last name and same sort of, I guess, quasi-political dynasty. But yeah, you were saying there was 100,000 more ballots that were cast by Democrats than Republicans in Pennsylvania. In Erie County, where Trump got most of his 2016 victory, 5,000 more Democrats voted than Republicans. In Charlie Dent's open seat in the Lehigh Valley, there were 42,000 votes in the Democratic primary, and yeah. Which was
and
about,
by the way, those things can sometimes be misleading because
right.
You have competitive races on one side and not on the other. But it was the case that the top of the ticket in the primary in Pennsylvania had competitive races on the Republican side and not on the Democratic side. You had an incumbent governor, Tom Wolf, an incumbent senator, Bob Casey, who are both Democrats, and you had contested primaries to challenge them on the Republican side. So logic would indicate that you would have more Republicans coming out because they had something to vote for. And yet you still had that outcome, and that suggests that the enthusiasm gap is, at least in Pennsylvania, pretty large.
And the other dynamic here was that, and you mentioned this, I mean, you implied it to a certain extent, but there was a lot of cases of a candidate not supported by the establishment, by the DCCC, in some instances by Emily's List, that ended up winning anyways. And
yeah,
this is in contrast to last week, where we didn't have quite this dynamic, where a lot of the sort of the Justice Dems and the Our Revolution candidates lost. You mentioned that there are two DSA candidates that won and are basically won the general election now, because there's no Republicans running against them. And
there's actually no Republican running, yeah. And then the big DCCC versus, establishment versus outsider race was in Nebraska, in a seat that's flipped back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. Kara Eastman, who is a pro-choice social worker, ended up winning very narrowly over Brad Ashford, who was DCCC endorsed and a former congressman who once held this seat and was trying to get it back. And he's a anti-choice, moderate conservative who has a, you know, conservative voting record in his one term in Congress. And so, you know, that's a really interesting race. And of course, what will remain to be seen is whether, given that that is a swing seat, whether the Democratic campaign committees will actually stay in the race, whether they will now support Kara Eastman, or whether they will, you know, assume the race is lost because there's some wild-eyed progressive who is running in the general election.
And let me ask you this, and I don't want to be cynical about this, but is it, would that be the only reason why they don't enter that race? In other words, is it possible that it's not just a question of, like, we assess that she's not going to win, so we're not going to be in?
Right.
Or is there also sort of an element of put aside ideology for a moment and just simply put in, like, sort of the almost quasi-corporate mentality of, I want to keep my job. She can't win.
Yeah.
Because if she wins, then I look like an idiot. And,
right.
I mean, this race.
Well, that's a very interesting case that you make. And just to preview something that I will have out later this week, there's some interesting political science research around whether parties support moderate candidates, which I think is pretty well established, whether they support them strategically because moderates tend to do better in these swing seats, or whether it's sincere. And the way that this particular researcher looked at it is that he looked at races where there was a competitive general election, or the expectation of a competitive general election, and races that were expected to be blowouts, where the strategic factor wasn't supposed to be, you know, an indicator, because it didn't matter. You were either going to, it's either going to be a safe seat or a seat that's completely out of reach. And what he found is that party support for moderates is actually stronger in the non-competitive seats than it is in the competitive seats. In both cases, parties support moderate candidates, but it doesn't seem strategic in any way. It seems far more sincere. So to answer your question, yes, there's a kind of, you know, I have to justify my job and justify this idea that we know best, you know, what is the case in these races. But there's this also sort of denial of reality that party organizations, this loose affiliated network of elected officials and campaign committees and donors, they have an ideological agenda of their own. And that is usually denied in favor of this idea that they're strategic geniuses. But if you look at the data, it appears that they are just as ideological on a different level as party activists.
Right. They just have a different ideology.
Correct.
And it's also the case with Kara Eastman that she did not get funding from Emily's List. Is that right?
That's correct. So this is a pro-choice woman running against a pro-anti-choice man in a Democratic primary. And the national groups largely stayed out. And, you know, there is certainly a linkage between Emily's List and the DCCC. You see that in race after race across the country. There may be a reluctance on the part, even though, you know, this is kind of a tailor-made seat for Emily's List to get involved in. There may be a reluctance to go against the national party in a big primary race. But, we'll see if Emily's List jumps in now.
You know, what's fascinating about this race is that if you remember, and it didn't necessarily work out too great, in some respects it did. But do you remember when Marcus Miletus, the proprietor of Daily Kos, basically mm-hmm. adopted John Tester and said that he was going to make that race about putting a stake through the heart of the DLC? That John Tester was a much better candidate. I remember when he went out there and he was talking about, like, I talked to the guy, he was literally sitting on his tractor, and we're going to do this case. We're going to push him in the primary as a way of taking out the DLC. And they were effective. Obviously, John Tester went on to win that primary. He won his election. John Tester did not turn out to be the guy that I think Marcus or any of us hoped that he would be. But with that said, there was a lot of other factors, but the DLC, in for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist anymore in and of itself, but even what it represented in the party is also highly diminished, right? I mean, we still have moderates, but you don't, and still maybe occasionally a blue dog, although you rarely hear about that. No labels was involved in some of these Democratic primaries, if I'm not mistaken. But I wonder if this seat, more than any other, is an opportunity to, because if I'm at the DCCC right now, I have got to be very careful. Because if I stay away from this race and Eastman still wins, I look really bad. But if I get in and help her win, I still have the opportunity of looking sort of bad in that I didn't support her in the beginning, right? I mean, so.
And if they don't get in and she loses and they try to dunk on a Democrat losing, that doesn't look great either. I don't think they're in much of a winning situation. We can look to history. You know, you mentioned the Tester race, but I think actually a closer analog for this particular race is in 2006. There was a race in New Hampshire with Carol Shea Porter, and Carol Shea Porter beat a conservative Democrat in the primary, and the DCCC bugged out. They said there's no way this anti-war activist would have any shot at winning a general election. We're out. And it turns out she won. She won the general election. And so that didn't seem to stop the dynamic necessarily, but it did show in that case. And there were a couple others, Jerry McNerney in California, who still is there today. He beat a right wing Democrat, and the DCCC kind of left that race, and he won the general election. It's certainly possible. I mean, there isn't really a hard and fast rule. There's some political science research that shows that more quote unquote extreme candidates do worse in general elections. But you know, you have to define your terms as to what is extreme.
Right.
Is supporting the idea of health care for all Americans an extreme idea? Is supporting the idea that we should not make education completely unaffordable to large sections of the population an extreme idea? That's the kind of thing, you know, when you talk about this sort of extremism or radicalism, you have to kind of define your terms.
Yeah, and I think more than in those past cycles, and I think those are good analogs, but more in those past cycles, the DCCC is under, I think, a lot more scrutiny. And
that's true.
And there is, if not the least of which, you know, stories that have come out of The Intercept, one of the places that you write for.
Right.
And even I would say the Theda Skocewol and Lena Putnam research, not as ideologically, ideology didn't seem quite as relevant, but this notion of the DCCC coming in and not knowing what they were doing and telling local people that they did, that dynamic is clearly there. And so, like, as an enterprise, they're under a lot of scrutiny, it seems to me.
That's true. And you know, mostly the one thing I would add is that the definition of a wave election is that it sweeps in people who have a certain label, a Democratic label in this case, attached to them, regardless of really their political, you know, the granular nature of their political ideology. If this is a national election where opposition to Donald Trump is driving massive turnout and will push Democrats in because they want to put a check on the power of the presidency, then does it matter exactly what political stance a certain candidate takes or not? That's, I think... it kind of undercuts this argument that you have to trim your sails in these particular seats and go with the most bland moderate candidate you can find.
Right. Well, so that's, did we leave any of those out? We spoke about Idaho, the gubernatorial primary. I think Paulette Jordan won. And that was also another sort of progressive win there, too, over a...
That's going to be a difficult race to win.
Yes, of course, of course. But it is encouraging to see, that
but
type...
The turnout matched, what we saw in these other races where the model, in the one Democratic kind of bastion in Idaho and Boise, she did this amazing turnout. So that is notable.
Pennsylvania, of course, is a huge linchpin because that could possibly provide about a quarter of the seats needed for the Democrats to pick up in 2018, coming from Pennsylvania alone.
Because of redistricting.
Yep.
That's because the state Supreme Court said that the maps that the Republican legislature put together were illegal, unconstitutional, and these new maps provide a real opportunity for Democrats to pick up seats.
And we should say, women, like you had mentioned, I think at the top, women won 17 out of the 20 races that they were involved in. So I don't know if about that number is exactly right, but certainly.
It's in the ballpark.
Yeah, it's in the ballpark, and it certainly is indicative of everything that we understand about this era, which is that women, particularly women of color, in depending on the locality.
Just personally, I'm looking at my ballots, California votes in a few weeks, and a judge's race and there are two candidates and all things being equal, I'm going to pick the woman. I think that our representation in legislatures and elected office and more generally is appalling in terms of the gender balance. And I think we need to make that right.
All right. Let's turn to I agree. Let's turn to a couple of pieces that you have up, and we'll start with the most recent first. One's at The Intercept, another one's at The New Republic. These are two things that I would say are in your wheelhouse after you talk about Highlights Magazine, and that would be banking regulations, writ large, and monopolies. We, I think, had spoken briefly, and I'm not sure if it was here or on Ring of Fire Radio, about the implications of the bill to, I guess, in some ways, begin to degrade Dodd-Frank. Just remind us what that bill did.
Right. Sure. So there's this bill, S-2155. It's often called the Crapo bill because Mike Crapo is the head of the Senate Banking Committee and he co-authored it.
Pretty sure that's pronounced Crapo.
I think that's not the only reason that people started calling it that. And the bill does unwind a number of regulations that were put in under the Dodd-Frank law, almost too numerous to count. It became sort of a Christmas tree with a bunch of ornaments of different little deregulatory measures, dozens of them within this bill. The idea is that it's supposed to help community banks and give them relief, but in reality, there are measures for virtually every type and size of financial institution. The biggest and most impactful measures affect what I call stadium banks, which are banks that aren't big enough to be maybe the biggest banks on Wall Street, but big enough to have a stadium named after them. It's certainly moves along the continuum of deregulating this industry that caused us so much pain only a decade ago.
And so the bill passes the Senate. It passes the House. It's about to pass the House.
Yeah. Next Tuesday now, it seems, is the date that has been picked. There was some confusion as to whether Jeb Hensarling, who's the head of the House Financial Services Committee, would allow this bill to be passed without more deregulation in it. He wanted other bills that he had shuttled through the committee to get attached to this. But finally, he seems to have relented, and it looks like there will be a final vote on this in the House. next week, and that's very likely to pass since Republicans are all for it. But I should say that in the Senate, where you needed Democratic support to get this done, 17 Senate Democrats out of the 49-member caucus voted for this bill.
Now, I have just coincidentally, I ran into two different people who worked at, and I can't remember the name of the bank, but it was one that issues U.S. bonds. It's a pretty vanilla bank as far as it goes. And I asked them about this legislation. And they both said, it's amazing to talk to people who work at banks about stuff like this, because they all go like, there's a vague, like, you don't really understand it. And it really is not that big of a deal. And I don't know why anybody's. And the real problem is blankety blank something else. And they both had almost the identical answer. They worked at the exact same bank, or I should say attitude and response, but their reasons were totally different. And I was amused by that, but there's already some unintended consequences, and ones that you, I suspect you thought were fairly predictable though, that are happening despite the fact that the legislation is yet to actually, the ink on the legislation is yet to dry. What are those consequences?
I would call them intended consequences. So the sort of justification that was given often by Senate Democrats as to why they need to pass this bill was that community banks are suffering, that they have this yoke of overregulation on their backs. And if we don't do something, we're going to see more of these community banks go out of business, and we're going to see more mass consolidation in the industry. So this bill would prevent consolidation in the banking industry. That was the core point that was made by a lot of Senate Democrats, including John Tester. In truth, this bill will accelerate consolidation in the banking industry, and there's very simple reason for that. The bill changes the threshold for enhanced regulatory standards from it used to be that a bank that had $50 billion or more in assets would get these enhanced standards, which were very, intrusive and
more scrutiny, essentially.
More scrutiny because they're big banks, and they might their failure would cause a cascade throughout the industry. Now it's $250 billion. So all these banks who were worried about going above that $50 billion level, now they have all this headroom. They don't have to worry about those enhanced standards until they get to $250 billion. So all of these banks at $40 billion, $30 billion, $20 billion, they don't have to worry about, they can scoop up as many small banks as they want, and they're not going to get dinged with higher regulations. So we're already seeing it. We're already seeing banks at that level buying up rivals. In Wisconsin, in Florida, in Texas, all over the country. And I've talked to bank mergers and acquisitions lawyers, and they're saying, yes, the last 2 years were flat, but now we're seeing a lot of acceleration on the consolidation. And this is, as you said, before the bill has even passed, but knowledgeable that the bill will pass. There's a smaller threshold that gets raised in this bill through, I think it's section 207 of the bill, that changes a threshold for a lower capital standard from $1 billion to $3 billion in assets. And most of these consolidations happen at that low level. It's a small community bank buying another small community bank to get bigger. Instead of having to grow organically, getting bigger through consolidation is much quicker, and it's a bigger, better path to growth. So that raising that standard, we're seeing a lot of consolidations at that lower level as well. And what this ends up doing is, if you're a bank and you buy a rival that's in a small community, a smaller community bank, you're likely to move the headquarters out of that small community.
Right.
And you're likely to decrease your lending within that small community because you're trying to grow your business. And the way to grow your business is where the population is. And frankly, it's not really in that rural community. So The whole purpose of this bill to
from the Democratic perspective, from the Democratic perspective,
the whole purpose of the bill to safeguard rural community lending is being undermined by the biggest provisions of the bill.
Well, there you have it. I already hear those people from that bank like, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, the whole idea of localization there is completely undermined by this.
And here's the most interesting part. So there's, you know, this is a long-term trend. Since the 1980s, in 1985, there used to be like 15,000 banks overall in the United States, and now they're 5,600. This is a long-term trend, and Dodd-Frank did nothing to change it, and this bill might only accelerate it.
Right.
The one area where community banks are thriving is in North Dakota. And why are community banks thriving in North Dakota, where there are more community banks per capita than any other state in the United States?
Well, hold on. Let's ask Matt. He's from North Dakota. Matt, do you know why?
Is it the state bank?
Boom.
It's because of the state bank. There's a public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, which partners with community banks on these lending projects and ensures a good deal of economic activity for these banks. And Heidi Heitkamp, the Democratic senator from North Dakota, knows this because she lives there and she voted for this bill. And she did not include, and she voted for this bill explicitly because she said there's this disaster happening with rural lending. But there's not a disaster happening in North Dakota with rural lending, and she could have brought that experience and principle to this bill, but she did not at all.
I think we should send Matt back to North Dakota and sit down with Heidi Heitkamp and explain to her what's going on with the banks in her own state. She apparently doesn't know. Well, listen, I want to get to the ticket monopoly story that you had, but I don't know if we do we have time. Do you have time? Because I know you got to jump soon.
I got about 10 minutes.
Sure. Okay, all right, great. So we have that issue, and that issue of consolidation with the banks. There's something. It's not too far afield in terms of the issue sets. I mean, one of the reasons why you do not want consolidation in these industries is so that you still have servicers supplying, you know, services on a local level, because there's a lot of benefits to it being local. Obviously, they make smarter loans, they make more targeted loans, they increase economic activity in more far afield places, I guess. The other problem with consolidation we're now seeing in the ticket market. Now, I haven't bought a ticket to anything in a long time, Dave.
But when you went on tour for your sold-out shows, Radio City, Staples Center, you know this business.
Of course. I know the business. Yeah, of course. But all right, so tell us what's happening, because you wanted to do this. You wanted to write this piece up so that antitrust issues would not be so,
remote. Yeah,
remote,
exactly.
And you want something a little more tangible. So you use the examples of ticket, show ticket monopoly. Tell us about that.
So people other than you buy tickets.
That's right.
To events, concerts, sporting events, whatever. And they recognize the same patterns that there's a release date for the tickets, and you get on the website and you're locked out and you're locked out, and within 5 minutes, all the tickets are gone. Or you get your ticket, and at the back screen, right before you purchase, you find out that there's some giant markup for a processing fee or a ticket facility fee or a million fees thrown onto the back end of the face value of the ticket price. Well, there was a government accountability office, which is sort of Congress's personal think tank, if you will, report on this event ticket industry. And it turns out, as we knew, that Ticketmaster controls about 80% of all primary event tickets. And then there's a secondary market, sort of a scalping market, where StubHub controls about 50% of that market. And the second biggest competitor is Ticketmaster, who has their own secondary market site called Tickets Now. Ticketmaster is owned by Live Nation Entertainment, which is one of the big event promoters. They manage artists. They own venues. So they're very vertically integrated. Live Nation bought Ticketmaster in 2010. The Justice Department allowed the deal to go through. They said that they put in conditions that would have allowed much more competition in this industry and prevented a Live Nation from saying, hey, we manage this artist. You have to use Ticketmaster to sell the tickets for this artist. But that's exactly what's happening. And the GAO report showed markups of between 27 and 31% on 27 to 31% of the face value is what you're paying in fees. And fees are about half of the total revenue of Live Nation Ticketmaster. Not the you know, managing of artists, not the owning of venues, the fees.
So nobody
on the individual tickets.
This is basically just sort of a classic case of so the bands don't see this, the venues don't see this. This is just, we're going to gouge you because we have the ability. This is just rent seeking on some level, right?
It's total rent seeking. It's exactly what it is. And you see it in the secondary market as well, where, you know, places, you know, ticket brokers use bots to take large percentages of tickets on the initial sale, or they use large staffs to buy up the tickets. And then they capitalizing on, you know, the sort of desperation of people who want to go to the show, they put in even greater markup on these tickets for people to get. So this is a consequence of monopoly that everybody sees, except for you, everybody sees in their daily lives when they go to, you know, want to have a little entertainment. So this, I think, is a good way of bringing this down to a very relatable level.
But we should also add, I mean, this is important, that it's not just a question of, you know, the problems with monopoly are not just that, you know, ticket prices are more expensive. There's a whole other realm, you know, because I want to make sure that people also get that the problem we have with antitrust is that it has been the conditions under which we would allow such a monopoly have been so narrowly tailored that there are other societal problems, right, that are associated with it.
That's true. I mean, in this particular case, there is a certain amount of rent-seeking and gouging going on. That's really the main issue. But you can also talk about the fact that if Live Nation, the company that designs distributes the tickets and also owns the venues, doesn't rep you as an artist, you're going to have a hard time getting in those venues. So the flip side of this is it makes it difficult on the producers, the people who want to deliver this entertainment, to get it out to the public. So that's sort of, they call that monopsony sometimes.
Yeah,
that's the flip side of monopoly. And you know, there are service issues, there's quality issues. If there's a glitch in the Live Nation service and they control 80% of the ticketing, suddenly you have a problem that's much bigger than just sort of one local problem. There are all sorts of ways in which this concentration of economic power and political power degrades modern life.
Let me just also say that the that monopsony that you spoke about, the way that trickles sort of downstream is that we literally probably have less access to good music because of it. I mean, that's a very, you know, sort of subjective notion. But regardless of what your idea of good music is, it narrows the opportunities for a whole wide range of music to exist and be commercially viable because of how narrow you have to fit into a hole to be successful, because there's only basically one buyer.
Right. And certainly what it means is that the sort of monopoly that is expressed by Live Nation of owning a certain number of venues and controlling the ticketing apparatus leads to a certain kind of monopoly or concentration in terms of the number of artists who are viable.
Right.
So it's sort of concentration creep, I've heard it described as, is that, you know, when you have this bottleneck in one side of an industry, it's going to lead to a bottleneck in another side of an industry. And in this case, it's artists who struggle. And they're not only going up against the sort of live event monopoly, but of course, they're going up against the fact that YouTube is streaming their music for pennies, or Spotify or Apple, and these narrow distribution networks make it difficult for them to get the music out. And then, you know, on the live event side, they struggle to get the best venues. So it's sort of an all encompassing thing.
David, Dan, people can check out that Monopoly piece in the New Republic. They can check out the Banks piece in the Intercept if they want to. The key for David Dayan, I say this every time, folks, the key, if you want your David Dayan fix, is go to daviddayan.tumblr.com. That's the inside dope. That's one of the bonuses you get by listening to this show. You find out where to get the real David Dayan stuff. David, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Sam. All right. Bye.
All right, folks. I'm not kidding about that Tumblr site. That's like, we sometimes will just go there and just watch. Like, you know how you could, like, you literally, it's like you could watch the grass grow, but you can actually see it growing. Like, you just see this guy just fill up the Tumblr page of like, oh, he's written another long form piece. Oh, another one. I've been looking at this for 30 minutes. I just seen him post three things that are at three different publications. Folks, reminder, support this program. Join the majoritireport.com. Just a couple of bucks a week keeps this free show going. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you a member show virtually every day. Also, today is Wednesday, which means that, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday was Tuesday. If memory serves, yesterday on the Michael Brooks show, you had Hartson, who is running for Senate in California against DiFi, and I guess Kevin De Leon would be the biggest competitors that she has.
Also, actually, I guess a Nazi who's polling pretty well there, too.
And of course, the Nazi. And
no, I mean, case literal. I deporting Jews is one of his main campaign plans.
He's a Republican, though, right?
Of course.
Oh, but it's a jungle primary. So really, they're running against everybody in this primary. And so I would definitively vote against a Nazi. I don't feel.
Well, I think it's just basic self interest voting.
There you go.
I think you guys are voting out of fear.
Yeah. Voting out of fear. And then
Bhaskar Sankara is also on. So you can check that out. Subscribe at iTunes, or check it out and subscribe, for that matter, at YouTube at youtube.com/Sam Cedar is our YouTube page. Also, you can head over to patreon.com/TheAntifada, which is Jamie's podcast, among other things that she does. And new ones dropping in a day.
It's dropping later today.
Later today.
We have an interview we did with a student at the Occupied New School, followed by a little bit of background on the university and occupations past.
So if you subscribe via patreon.com/TheAntifada, you won't even have to know when it's going to drop. It'll show up in your mailbox, your email box.
That's right.
All right, folks, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Our number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number, or you can IM the show via the app at majorityapp.com. It's a free iOS or Android app at majorityapp.com. Going to take a quick break. Head to the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.